Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's All of It on WNYC. I'm Carrie Nolan. The trailer for the new Nat Geo TV series, Restaurants at the End of the World, shows chef Kristen Kish navigating her way up a Panamanian mountain, first in a stick shift Jeep. Spoiler alert, it stalls out, and then hiking through a rainforest, all for a meal at a restaurant at the summit. Now, we'll talk more about that in a moment. You may remember Kristen as the 10th season champion on the show Top Shelf. Chef, not shelf. She also has a life story that would make for a grand movie or maybe a TV series. She's been an executive chef in Boston, a line cook in Michigan, a rudderless 20-something, and is an adoptee from Korea. Her gorgeous cookbook, Kristen Kish Cooking, Recipes and Techniques, came out a while back. We'll talk about that as well. Kristen, welcome to All of It.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
You say in the trailer for Restaurants at the End of the World that you wanted to be pushed out of your culinary comfort zone. Well, what was that zone, and how did you instinctively know that you needed to be pushed out of it?
You know, I think that, you know, I don't have a word. The easiest way to put it is like you're bored a little bit in life, or maybe stagnant. Mm-hmm. Not saying that you don't enjoy everything you're doing, but
right.
Certainly there is this next gear that is worth exploring to help your creativity, to fuel some inspiration. And I think regardless if you're in cooking or not, it's always really important to step into that space. So for me, I knew it was time. It's long been time. I know how to cook. I know how to cook in my kitchens and places kind of all over the world. But how to do that while also being able to learn about someone else while we traverse mountainsides and we really actively pursue these ingredients.
Let's talk a little bit about your journey from a kid playing in the kitchen and turning everything into sawdust, as you say in the book, to where you are now. You said that you felt like you finally belonged when you first went to culinary school in Chicago. How did that feel? I mean, how did you know?
You know, I always loved cooking. I loved watching television shows about cooking, and I knew how to use a knife at 5 years old because I've watched them mm-hmm. cut and chop, and I knew how to do it. I think like a lot of kids and young adults, this process of trying to find yourself and where you belong and what you feel like you're good at, because growing up, you know, from the moment you hit middle school, it's like, well, what do you want to do for the rest of your life? And that's a really daunting place to be, especially with, you know, me, a kid with a lot of uncertainty, insecurity, anxiety, all the things
right.
That make for a great TV host were challenging me. And, you know, I think finding a sense of belonging in the fact that you felt good at something, because for a long time, I just never thought I would be good at anything. So to feel good at something was a really wonderful place to be. I hadn't yet found that outside of the kitchen,
right.
But to step into it in a kitchen was really necessary for me.
So let's do a little thumbnail about where you went after you graduated from culinary school.
So after culinary school in Chicago, I had a lot of challenges. Again, this idea of feeling good in school, mm-hmm. but also then going into the real world, I hadn't yet figured myself out. And so I was closeted at the time, very much openly gay now, but I was definitely hiding a lot of me
mm-hmm.
And trying to understand what the world was going to do for me. And that's the way I looked at it, instead of thinking, well, what can I do for myself and, you know, for the people and things around me? And so I had a rough go for the next like 4 months. It was pretty tough for me. I ended up moving back home after Chicago, living with my parents because they refused to support a deadbeat child, basically, not really doing anything for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I figured it out. Like they were like, well, where do you want to go next? And I said, Boston. And they were like, you get one more shot at this. We hope that you do well. Just get a job and try to do something.
Right.
And I had to step outside of my then comfort zone to find out who I was and what I wanted to become.
We'd love to hear from you, listeners. Give us a call. We've got a lot to talk about. This Nat Geo show, Restaurants at the End of the World, this beautiful cookbook, and a very loquacious guest. So, Kristen Kish is our guest. Our number is 212 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Once you got to Boston, you hooked up with a very successful chef. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little about that.
You know, going to Boston, still feeling a little bit lost. I had a series of couple jobs before I found my way to Chef Barbara Lynch. And she is a pioneer. She is an icon, certainly in a lot of people's eyes, mine included. And the greatest thing about a mentor, I feel, is that you aren't looking for it. And it's exactly the person you need in your life at that time. And I've always said, she never taught me how to cook. Right. She taught me how to believe in myself and understand that being me was actually the best thing for me. And she did that simply by being herself in every way possible. And just by watching her, I was like, gosh, that looks freeing. Just to settle into who you are without any kind of like hesitation or guilt or insecurity. And I was fascinated by this woman. And I worked with her for about 4.5 years, and she's the one who put me up for Top Chef.
Ah, okay. So Anthony Bourdain once said that of all the competitive cooking shows, that he felt Top Chef was the most honest.
It is. It's very honest. Anxiety's real. Okay. You go through a whole slew of emotions, but it was one of the greatest, greatest pleasures of my life.
You've hosted or co-hosted 3 shows on various channels. Mm-hmm. How did Restaurants at the End of the World come about?
So it started with the seed of an idea in 2019 by a woman named Julia, and she had this idea about family meal. So in restaurants, we have this thing called family meal. Everyone eats together at the restaurant before you go into work. And we started exploring that. 2020 happened. Everything came to a screeching halt. And then what happened was we picked it up at the back end of 2020, and National Geographic then got a hold of it and, you know, through pitches and things, and they showed a lot of interest. And National Geographic and the president of Nat Geo, Courtney Monroe, they saw something in the seed of an idea and then completely expanded it for National Geographic. So this is why now we are traveling to the ends of the world and why I'm rappelling down waterfalls, because, you know, it's an iconic brand.
I have to ask you about rappelling down a waterfall to get a handful of watercress.
Yes.
I need to know more. Yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of people are like, well, did you have to do that? Certainly not.
Right.
But like, how do people forage and how do they get things from their environment when they live in a rainforest? And this is what he does. He has been rappelling down that waterfall for I don't know how many years, Rolando. And that's just the way he did it. Does he do it because he needs to do it for watercress? He could probably find watercress somewhere else.
Right.
However, he loves the adventure too. So it's like mixing these two things together and saying, well, you don't have to, but you can. And it's available to you. And so being able to go on this adventure with him was incredible.
Let's talk a little bit about this first episode, which, by the way, airs tonight on Nat Geo. And the series will be available starting tomorrow on Disney Plus. The Cloud Forest Kitchen, it's Hacienda Mamacelo?
Mamacillo.
Mamacillo.
Yep.
Tell us about this restaurant. How did you find this? How did you took your Jeep as far as you could take it and then had to hike to the restaurant?
Yeah. Luckily, we have a really wonderful casting department that leads us into wonderful creative zones. So there's a lot of things that come into play, obviously pre-production.
Right.
But eventually, I did find my way to Rolando and his family. And this all started because, Rolando was an airline pilot for Copa Airlines in Panama City.
Mm-hmm.
And him and his wife had this dream of raising their children in a slightly more organic way and out of the city. So they bought this plot of land. They built this house. He built this house with his own 2 hands. And why not start farming? Because you have this like breadbasket of beautiful Caribbean mist that's coming in. You have the most perfect climate and soil to grow stuff on. So he just started experimenting. And through his time, he found mentors and people that knew a lot more about this stuff to teach him. But ultimately, it was his family home that he convinced his wife to start feeding people during adventure tours.
How many people, you know, how big is this living room / restaurant?
So they typically sit around, you can do 2 people or you can do like 15 or 16. But for for my time there, he was feeding the largest group yet to date, which was 30 people.
That's a lot.
There's a lot of people for a home kitchen. A home kitchen without an oven, and a husband-wife team that have never worked in restaurants before.
My jaw just literally dropped. What was on the menu?
Oh, gosh. So it's a farm, and they have happy animals, and they feed their family these chickens from their chicken coop and goat milk from their beautiful goats. So we had homemade goat cheese they had made. Coffee, obviously, in Panama is gorgeous. And he has his own coffee, so we made this thing called coffee bread. We had the most deliciously organic chicken that I've ever had in my entire life, which was stunning, with, of course, watercress. And he has citrus trees, you know, out in his front yard, and gorgeous wild berries just hanging around in his backyard. So we used everything and everything we could.
My guest is Kristen Kish. She is the host of the brand new Nat Geo series, Restaurants at the End of the World. It drops tonight at 10 o'clock Eastern here on Nat Geo TV, and it will stream starting tomorrow on Disney Plus. She also has this beautiful cookbook out that came out a couple of years ago called Kristen Kish Cooking, Recipes and Techniques. If you have any questions for her, you want to know about foraging for watercress down the side of a waterfall or something perhaps a little closer to home, give us a call. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. You also went to Norway in this. So tell us a little bit about that. Tease that out for us.
So we say Norway, but yes, technically it's Norwegian territory, but it's between mainland Norway, the northern part, and the North Pole. And there's a little town called Svalbard, which is 78 degrees north, if I remember correctly, and in a place where there are said to be more polar bears than there are humans. So that certainly was an incredibly new place for me. That challenged a lot of who I was, you know, being in the Arctic and having to have a polar bear guard with you at all times. You couldn't leave the hotel, this hotel that we were in, without a guard. And when we went diving in the Arctic for one of the scenes, there was a polar bear on the coast, and we had to switch locations because it was too close.
What were you foraging for under the sea?
We were trying. Well, the original dive spot had beautiful sea urchins. Since we had to then come up with Plan B and go to another spot, there were no more sea urchins there. So in real time, we're trying to find stuff that's not there. And you know, at the end of the day, we got a little bit of seaweed, but the biggest part about that was the fact that I got to go swimming in the Arctic. Yeah. I was in a 7-millimeter wetsuit. And if you've ever had to put one of those on, it's more challenging than the dive itself.
Now, you go from a rainforest in Panama to, you know, within a stone's throw, if you have a good arm, of the North Pole. Mm-hmm. And then what seems like kind of a return to normal, it's sort of a palate cleanser, an island in Maine.
Yeah. You know, I think the beauty of visiting domestic places, obviously the show will go international, so our little island off the coast of Maine will feel like the most end of the earth for somebody watching somewhere else. But for me, being a New England kid and having, you know, grown up for 10 years of my professional career in Boston, being able to go to places that are seemingly in your own backyard, and you are constantly surprised by. I had never heard of North Haven. I had never heard of Turner Farm. And the luxury of travel, it is a true luxury. Not everyone can just jet out on a plane to the middle of nowhere.
Right.
And I think it's a nice reminder to say that there are places worth exploring that are just so close to you and that have something so magical that it is worth going to.
Let's talk a little bit about your book. Mm-hmm. I have not stopped thumbing through it. And for some reason, the universe is telling me that I have to make the halibut recipe in here.
Yeah.
Because every time I've opened this book, it opens to that page. Mm-hmm. What I find about the book is that it's elegant. It's sort of, it's fine dining, but it's not fussy.
Mm-hmm.
Everything seems very, very clean flavor-wise.
Sure.
Obviously, that's your style.
Mm-hmm.
What led you to do this particular cookbook?
You know, the cookbook started, Top Chef obviously opens up a lot of doors.
Right.
Especially if you win. So I was very fortunate to have a lot of opportunities come my way. And a cookbook was, you know, it just seemed like a really fun project to do. I had never done it before, and I was always intrigued by having something that you could, like, give to your friends and family that is a tangible, tactical item that you can say, look at what I did.
Right.
And it's a really proud moment. And so this book came about, and it was just, it was so heavily focused on technique with my food story involved. And at the end of the day, I hope, because we lay out techniques, that people can take these recipes and start to swap ingredients in and out. They might not like it. They might not find something that they can, you know, is at their local grocery store. But at the end of the day, I give you the basics. And then from there, it is up to you to create your own food story based off of the roadmap that I gave you.
And that roadmap is so clear and so well-defined in this book that I don't know if you follow the recipe before you, you know, feel confident enough to swap things out. If you follow the recipe, it's going to work. It just seems like this book was so thoroughly tested.
It was. We had a lot of great people involved. I will say there was one mistake in the book, which I will have no problem calling out that I made a mistake. There's a cake in the back. It's like this pecan coffee cake kind of thing. And it's an 8-inch round cake. But what I forgot to mention was it's the deep 8-inch. I didn't mention the depth. I just mentioned the width.
And
so you do have a lot of batter if you were to use, I guess, like pick a 8-inch, like 2-inch deep cake pan. So when you go to make that, you want to use a deeper one. Because in restaurants, often we have the deeper ones because you can make thin cakes. You can make thick cakes.
Right.
So I did not mention that small thing.
Also, the pink peppercorn ice cream.
Yes.
Delicious. Yes.
Let's,
going back to the restaurants at the end of the world, what was for you the most kind of impressive off the beaten path place you went to?
You know, I've had the great fortune of eating a lot of fantastic food in my life and going to really beautiful locations. But the thing that I find the most impressive is a person. It's not about the place. It's not about what they're feeding me. It's not about any of that. It's about who the person is. And that is the seed and the start of a great food story and a great food journey. And so, you know, I'm impressed by things that I eat, sure. But I will say that when we were in Svalbard with a chef named Regier, he was taking parts of the animal that I had never tasted before. I've had stomachs. I've had brains. I've had eyeballs. I've eaten all the things that, you know, one can eat.
Right.
But he took this from a ptarmigan. It's a grouse. And he took this feeding pouch where they collect a bunch of seeds and, you know, stuff to collect. And if they can't feed themselves over the winter, they'll regurgitate it and swallow it.
Okay.
You know, survival.
Right.
Basic survival. And he took that feeding sack and he infused it in a gin. He took me out to get glacier ice at this gorgeous glacier. We pull up and I'm just like, I mean, in awe.
Yeah.
And we make a cocktail out of glacier ice and this feeding sack cocktail. I can't say that it was the most delicious thing I've drank, but I was the most impressed by his innovation, his creativity. I always say you want to eat all parts of the animal, right? Mm-hmm. We've heard that so many times. But this one was like, do you actually need to have that in order to, like, honor the animal? I don't know, but he did, and it was my first taste of something like that.
I'm trying to remember it correctly, but you also talked about a dish made with antelope tongue. Was it antelope?
Reindeer. Yep. So they have a Svalbard reindeer, and they are everywhere. It's like, you know, how people hunt maybe for deer, right? In the States, and we're used to hearing that. Over there, there's these reindeers just roaming everywhere. And, you know, naturally it's a game meat that is super tasty. And he was doing a reindeer tongue pastrami. So I've never had reindeer and I'd never had reindeer tongue before. So that was a new experience. It was delicious.
I was just going to ask you, what can you compare it to?
It tastes like a venison or a lighter version of a game meat. Tasted like something very familiar. It didn't feel out of the ordinary for me.
Who in the culinary world now impresses you?
God, there's so many. I mean, all my friends. Like, I love, and I know it's a different project, but when I was co-hosting Iron Chef on Netflix, I got to watch my friends, peers, and colleagues do what they do best. And I got to have the vantage point. The greatest part of that job of co-hosting, yes, I don't want to have to competitively cook anymore.
Right.
But to have this podium where I could watch my friends and people do what they love and do it so well, that is one of the greatest, greatest job pleasures I think I've ever had, because that was incredible. So my friends impress me. They do. I'm inspired by each and every one of them.
And they by you, I'm sure.
I hope so.
The show is Restaurants at the End of the World. It starts tonight on Nat Geo TV. If you want to stream it, you can do that starting tomorrow on Disney Plus. Kristen Kish, I'm so delighted to meet you. I can't wait to see the entire series, and I can't wait to start cooking from this book.
Yes.
The Halibut is definitely on my my short list.
Good. It's a really great dish.
No doubt. Before I let you go, you said, as I said earlier, you wanted to be pushed out of your comfort zone. What was the least comfortable thing you had to eat other than the feeding sack?
You know, the thing about food is, whether it's new to me or it's something I've had before, I approach new things with the understanding that it is a normal for somebody else. And, you know, I think in the food world, there's been this term exotic cuisine thrown around, which really bothers me. I think it implies that something is not normal, but it is normal to somebody. It just might not be normal to us. And I love trying new things. I love trying familiar or new or different and all the things, because I think that really sparks inspiration and also a level of education to learn what somebody else eats.
Thank you so much for coming in. This has been such a pleasure. So nice to meet you. Kristen Kish, again, the host of Restaurants at the End of the World, starts tonight on Nat Geo TV and is going to be streaming tomorrow on Disney+. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.